And now,
the definition.
It's formally and finally what Occupy Wall Street says and wants. It is, in essence, their special comment. As we gather together in solidarity to express a feeling of mass injustice, we must not lose sight of what brought us together. We write so that all people who feel wronged by the corporate forces of the world can know that we are your allies. As one people, united, we acknowledge the reality that the future of the human race requires the cooperation of its members, that our system must protect our rights, and upon corruption of that system, it is up to the individuals to protect their own rights and those of their neighbors, that a democratic government derives its just power from the people. But corporations do not seek consent to extract wealth from the people and the earth, and that no true democracy is attainable when the process is determined by economic power. We come to you at a time when corporations, which place profit over people, self-interest over justice, and oppression over equality, run our governments. We have peaceably assembled here, as is our right, to let these facts be known. They have taken our houses through an illegal foreclosure process, despite not having the original mortgage. They have taken bailouts from taxpayers with impunity and continue to give executives exorbitant bonuses. They have perpetuated inequality and discrimination in workplaces based on age, the color of one's skin, sex, gender identity, and sexual orientation. They have poisoned the food supply through negligence and undermined the farming system through monopolization. They have profited off the torture, confinement, and cruel treatment of countless animals and actively hide these practices. They have continuously sought to strip employees of the right to negotiate for better pay and safer working conditions. They have held students hostage with tens of thousands of dollars of debt on education, which is itself a human right. They have consistently outsourced labor and used that outsourcing as leverage to cut workers' health care and pay. They have influenced the courts to achieve the same rights as people with none of the culpability or responsibility. They have spent millions of dollars on legal teams that look for ways to get them out of contracts in regards to health insurance. They have sold our privacy as a commodity. They have used the military and police force to prevent freedom of the press. They have deliberately declined to recall faulty products, endangering lives in pursuit of profit. They determine economic policy, despite the catastrophic failures their policies have produced and continue to produce. They have donated large sums of money to politicians who are responsible for regulating them. They continue to block alternate forms of energy to keep us dependent on oil. They continue to block generic forms of medicine that could save people's lives or provide relief in order to protect investments that have already turned to substantial profit. They have purposely covered up oil spills, accidents, faulty bookkeeping, and inactive ingredients in pursuit of profit. They purposefully kept people misinformed and fearful through their control of the media. They have accepted private contracts to murder prisoners, even when presented with serious doubts about their guilt. They have perpetuated colonialism at home and abroad. They have participated in the torture and murder of innocent civilians overseas. They continue to create weapons of mass destruction in order to receive government contracts. To the people of the world, we, the New York City General Assembly, occupying Wall Street in Liberty Square, urge you to assert your power, exercise your right to peaceably assemble, occupy public space, create a process to address the problems we face, and generate solutions accessible to everyone. To all communities that take action and form groups in the spirit of direct democracy, we offer support, documentation, and all of the resources at our disposal. Join us and make your voices heard. The statement issued from Zuccotti Park by the General Assembly at Occupy Wall Street.
Protests against Wall Street are spreading today to a number of major U.S. cities, including right here in the nation's capital. President Obama says the demonstrations are expressing the frustration that so many Americans feel right now about the economy, jobs, and the fallout from the financial crisis. Democrats are trying to harness the anger of the growing Occupy Wall Street movement that some see as sort of a left-wing answer to the Tea Party. Joining us now, Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont. He's an independent who caucuses with the Democrats. Senator, thanks very much for coming in. Let me get right to this Occupy Wall Street demonstration that's going on around the country right now. What do you think about this?
Well, I applaud them. I think the president is right. They are speaking to the real anger and frustration that millions of Americans feel at a time when the middle class is collapsing, poverty is increasing, the people on top are doing phenomenally well, and the people, Wolf, who caused this damn recession in the first place, the folks on Wall Street because of their greed and illegal behavior, you know what their punishment has been? They're now making more money than they ever made before. So what the demonstrators are saying, there's something wrong with that picture, and they're exactly correct.
Because the president at the news conference today was asked about all the Wall Street bankers in 2008, 2009. You say illegal activity. No one, as far as they know, has gone to jail, let alone even been charged with any illegal activity in causing this crisis. Do you know of anyone who's been charged with a crime?
Well, I think there is some investigations, and I think there are, you know, hopefully they will lead to criminal charges. But what I think the average American is saying, that a kid smokes marijuana, that kid can end up in jail. These people, because of their activity, destroyed the economy. Millions of people lost their jobs, their homes, their life savings, and now they're making more money than they ever did before. So I applaud what the folks, the Wall Street demonstrators, are talking about. But now what we got to do is put some meat on that bone. We have to come up with some specific ideas in terms of how you deal with Wall Street. I'll give you one example, Wolf. Many people don't know this. The six largest financial institutions in this country have assets the equivalent of 60% of the GDP of the United States of America. 60% of our GDP, some $7 trillion. In my view, everything being equal, they will once again, because of their reckless activity, come back before Congress in a too big to fail situation. They will need to be bailed out again. In my view, we have got to break up these financial institutes right now, bring some competition to the financial industry. Furthermore, you have large banks, Bank of America, the others, they are charging interest rates on people's credit cards of 25 or 30%. That's called usury. We've got to regulate interest rates and demand that the Fed take that kind of action. So we need some real specific Wall Street reform which protects the American people.
Do you want to share with us who's being investigated right now for criminal activity on Wall Street?
Well, I think, no. I think it's something has been in the front pages of the paper, so I've nothing more to than that.
Is the Obama administration MIA when it comes to all these problems? Because it's been in business now for almost 3 years.
If you're asking me, do I believe there should have been a thorough Wall Street investigation, that there should have been prosecutions 2 or 3 years ago, the answer is absolutely. If you're asking me, is the Obama administration been bringing on board financial advisors who were too close to Wall Street? Absolutely. So, you know, I think we should have been much more aggressive in going after Wall Street. I'll give you another example. We found out, I got a provision in Dodd-Frank, which showed that during the financial crisis, the Fed provided $16 trillion on a revolving basis of low-interest loans to every large financial institution in America, central banks all over the world, many large corporations. Right now in America, you have small businesses desperately in need of affordable capital. They can't find it. Why is not the Fed responding to the needs of American small business people who want to expand, who want to grow jobs, with the same sense of urgency that they responded to Wall Street in their moment of crisis?
The president's jobs bill, it's going to come up next week in the Senate. You're a senator, but a lot of people are suggesting, why is the president proposing legislation that he knows is not going to pass, not even pass not the House of Representatives, but even some of your fellow Democrats, if you will, and I know you're an independent, but even some Democrats say they can't vote for the president's plan.
I'm not so sure that that's the case. I think what the president has got to do, and what the media has got to do, is appreciate the urgency of the moment. And we don't. The reality is unemployment in America today, Wolf, is not 9%. Real unemployment, including those who have given up looking for work and are working part-time when they want to work full-time, is 16%, 25 million Americans. What the president has got to do is come up with a bold jobs program. I would go further than he did. I would put more emphasis on rebuilding our crumbling infrastructure, transforming our energy system. But the president has got to say to the American people, we need to create millions and millions of jobs. And if any Republican out there does not want to support job creation, you got to hold that person politically accountable. That is the issue of the moment. 16% unemployment, young people getting out of high school, getting out of college, can't find jobs. Older workers seeing their wages go down. We need to rebuild this economy.
I want you to listen, Senator Sanders, to Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain speaking out today. Listen to this.
If you are envious of somebody that happens to be rich, that you call a fat cat, go and get rich instead of expecting them to walk outside of their office and write you a check. That's not the way America works. Work for it.
All right, you want to respond to
Yeah, I think Mr. Kane got it wrong. That's exactly how America works. Historically, what we have said is, especially in a moment when the wealthiest people are becoming wealthier, when we have the most unequal distribution of income and wealth, what we have historically done is say yes to the wealthiest people in this country. You're going to have to pay more in taxes, and especially at this moment when the real effective tax rate for the very rich is the lowest that it has been in decades, of course they're going to have to contribute to help us get this economy.
On Monday night, Michael visited the Occupy Wall Street protest in Lower Manhattan. Police have barred the protesters from using any form of public address system at the encampment, so the crowd amplified Michael's comments by repeating them in unison.
Whatever you do, don't despair, because this is the hard part. You're in the hard part right now.
Whatever you do, don't despair.
But everyone will remember. Three months from now. 100 years from now.
100 years from now.
That you came down to this plaza.
That you came down to this plaza.
And you started this movement.
That was Michael Moore addressing the Occupy Wall Street protesters in Lower Manhattan. Well, for the remainder of the hour, we're delighted to have him right here in studio. And we won't be repeating everything you say, Michael, although it's an ingenious system when you're not allowed to use a microphone.
Yeah, it's a little weird at first because it sounds like either you're reciting the rosary in church or that scene in Life of Brian where the whole crowd just repeats everything that Brian says. But the reason they do it is because the police have not allowed them to have any amplification. So in order for the people to hear in the back, everyone around you just shouts out what you just said so everybody can hear it. I thought it was actually kind of an interesting and workable idea.
Well, we've put out to the world that you were coming in today, mm-hmm. and of course the questions came in on Facebook. We tweeted this, and people can tweet back right now. But when we posted the question on Facebook, what do you want to ask Michael Moore? Tausif Khan wrote, what do you think is the next step the protesters need to take to get Washington and Wall Street to listen and to make real change?
They don't need to worry about a next step. It's already happening. This is something that has sort of sprung up. There's no group, organized group. There's no dues-paying, members-only organization behind this. Excuse me. This is literally an uprising of people who've had it. And it has already started to spread across the country in other cities. It will continue to spread. It has to start somewhere. It started here with a few hundred. It will grow, and really already has grown here, to a few thousand, and will be tens of thousands and then hundreds of thousands of people. Because what I was telling them the other night is the great thing about what they're doing, and the great thing, great in the sense that their work ahead is not as difficult as other movements in the past. When the women's liberation movement began, when people began protesting against the Vietnam War, civil rights movement, at the beginning of those movements, the majority of the country was not with them, did not believe in the basic principles of any of those philosophies. That's not true right now. The majority of Americans are really upset at Wall Street. The millions of Americans have lost their homes or are facing foreclosure right now. 50 million do not have health insurance. 14 million officially are unemployed, and it's probably well up into the 20 million plus people that are actually unemployed. So you've already got an army of Americans who are just waiting for somebody to do something, and the something has started.
And it is so interesting. If you had 2,000 people as the first weekend, 12 days ago, 2,000 Tea Party activists down on Wall Street, you probably have double the number of reporters there.
Oh, my God.
But at the beginning of this,
nothing.
Very little coverage. This is day 12. And I wanted to talk about what happened this past weekend,
sure.
The New York Police Department's handling of the arrests of 80 protesters over the weekend. That's come under fire as a number of videos have emerged showing officers using heavy-handed tactics, to say the least. Protesters captured some of the attacks on video, including the arrest of a 21-year-old Bronx resident named Iro Vincent. He was trying to calm the crowd and organize people to leave. This is a clip from after he was released from jail.
That's when the police just charged at me with his fist and just started, you know, swinging at me. Another policeman pushed me, and I'm backing up. And as I'm backing up, I hit the barricade, and then they come at, I look at them, they come at me. I go over, and then four policemen just started, you know, beating on me, yelling at me, stop resisting arrest while I'm just laying there. I'm not fighting back. They kicked me in my stomach, knocked the breath out of me, hit me with their baton. They put their knees into my face, not in my head, into my face, into the ground, and just laughing.
While other demonstrators were charged with blocking traffic and resisting arrest, Vincent faces the most serious charge of assaulting a police officer. The NYPD says they acted appropriately, but Vincent says he's confident the videos of the attack will exonerate him and has vowed to continue participating in the Occupy Wall Street protest.
If there's anything called the epitome of a struggle, me and my family lived it. We were foreclosed on. My father had trouble finding a job, still hasn't found one. I had trouble finding a job, still haven't found one. My sister's in college, her tuition's doubling. They're trying to fight for her financial aid. We struggle with food. I've even slept on the bench a few nights before this occasion, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I'm here for everybody in my family, not just myself, and everybody who goes through the same struggles that I can empathize with.
Michael, your comments on Iro Vincent and all that are down there.
Well, it's highly ironic that now over 100 of the protesters have been arrested, and not a single banker, CEO from Wall Street, anyone from corporate America, nobody, not one arrest of any of these people who brought down the economy in 2008, who created schemes, financial schemes that not only destroyed the economy, but took away the future of this generation, of this young man and his children in the future. They have completely ruined it for people while they have become filthy rich at the same time. Not one of them arrested, but 100 of these people who have stood up nonviolently against this madness. And they're arrested. This just boggles the mind. And I want to say something too, because I mean, Amy, you've lived here in this area, in the city, probably most of your life. I've been here for many years. By and large, the New York City cops are actually pretty good as police forces go. I can tell you from filming around the country. You know,
I think it depends where we live.
Well, this is what I was going to say. Yes, that what's rough here is that when you have the bad apples, they are really bad here. And it's not just one or two. I think it's very important to also, when you look at this videotape and the other videotape that was shot that day of the people, especially the one individual who was pepper spraying the women right in their eyes. When they were standing there doing nothing. Those were the white-shirted management types. They were not just the the street officers. These were the guys that were supposed to be in charge of them. They were the ones going up there. So, you know, it's one thing if you've got a rogue cop that's behaving violently, but when you have management, when you have the white shirts there of the NYPD doing this, that's not rogue. That's policy. That's coming from somewhere else. That they've been told by those in charge to corral this thing, end this thing, stop this thing. And it was just somebody should inform them that everybody is a filmmaker now. Everybody has a camera. And you cannot just treat people like this and get away with it. And I hope they don't get away with it.
We begin right here in New York City. There was a march on Wall Street today, sponsored by the group Occupy Wall Street and, oddly enough, Sonny D. For extreme protest thirst. The Occupy Wall Street movement has basically been a four-week downtown Manhattan live-in, which has spread to cities all around the country, causing the media to move its coverage dial from blackout to circus. It's too bad. Those are the only two settings it has. Intrepid reporters from all the major networks and CNN went down to talk with the protesters. Of course, the reporters changed into their undercover 21 Jump Street outfits. What's up, protesters? Mind if we chillax with you in HD? Because the aspect ratio on the shot's gonna be badass. Why are the protesters there? Well, the answers ranged from extremely earnest college roommatey to powerful and cogent.
What do you guys want?
Bring attention to the pervasive influence that corporations have in the political process.
What do we as Americans agree on? What can we do about it?
We the people are here to take the power back.
Now, after 30 years of having our living standards decrease while the wealthiest 1% have had it better than ever, I think it's time for maybe, I don't know, some participation in our democracy.
Damn! That motherfucker brought game! You know what he's saying? What's up, Tea Party? I see your tri-corner hat, and I raise you a Union Soldier kepi. So those are the protesters, or to put their words another way.
I think if you put every single left-wing cause into a blender and hit power, this is the sludge you'd get.
I saw one guy with a guitar, and they asked him, you know,
it's very hippie.
It's like Woodstock meets Burning Man meets people with absolutely no purpose.
They are some of the most uninformed people, if you listen to them.
They're all over the map.
Demolition of capitalism. If we learn to share, we can all live in prosperity.
All of those quotes could have been said in 1789 France before the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, or with only slight modification when the Nazis were coming to power. This is always the beginning of totalitarianism.
This group is a laughable gang of disorganized, confused Nazis. This is an ill-disciplined, highly trained, weed-smoking fascist organization. But the protesters do have some surprising defenders.
You know, the average American taxpayer knows that at the end of the day, they're going to be on the hook for the trillions and trillions of dollars that we're using to bail out these companies, some of whom have been irresponsible, and they are expressing their frustration, which I think is quintessentially American.
Bravo, bravo, Sean Hannity. Breaking ranks with your conservative friends. Oh, that's a clip from 2009 about the Tea Party? What does Sean Hannity think about these protesters' frustration?
They hate corporations, they hate capitalism, and in the end, ultimately, they want statism over free market, so they really don't like freedom.
Oh. All right. So rage against duly elected government is patriotic, quintessentially American, whereas rage against multinational shareholder accountable corporations is anti-American. Gotcha. Okay, that's good. I don't get it. Here's a group of Americans, disenchanted, railing against big government bailouts, angry because they played by the rules, worked hard, now they're in debt from student loans and they're unemployed. I mean, look, if this thing turns into throwing trash cans into Starbucks windows, nobody's going to be down with that.
We all love Starbucks.
But these protesters, how are they not like the Tea Party? All right, some of them, you know, smoke and have pants made out of pot. So call them the THC Party. Aren't these folks real citizens with real problems? Aren't they also speaking for America?
These folks aren't speaking for America.
Just your basic green, anti-capitalist, anti-bank, anti-Wall Street, anti-America demonstration?
That's not Tea Party behavior. That's not America-loving behavior.
They probably don't even masturbate to the Constitution. That's what I think. All right, I'll bite. Why Why are the Occupy Wall Street folks unworthy of Tea Party respect and ideals?
They're not law-abiding citizens. They're camping in a park where camping isn't allowed. They're breaking the laws on the Brooklyn Bridge. That's not Tea Party behavior.
Everything you described there, I believe, is a misdemeanor. The actual Tea Party was a felony. Do you know how much trouble? I mean, do you know what the Tea Party actually was? You know how much trouble you get in if you broke into a ship, stole the cargo from the ship's owners, and just threw it overboard? Not to mention the EPA fines and the damage it would do to your Indian costume. The Tea Party namesake, you're named after the most celebrated act of theft and vandalism of private property in our nation's history, and you can't stomach a little park camping? But if there is one criticism that nearly everyone, even their supporters, seem to share, it was this.
When you look at the message, though, what is it these protesters are trying to get across here? Because it doesn't necessarily seem a very cohesive one.
Seems like they're really going to have to crystallize their message.
The message is muddled.
What? Did you just call the protesters muggles? But I watch a lot of movies. But this guy brings up a good point. We cannot expect a bunch of disenfranchised park dwellers to come up with a coherent solution to our nation's economic woes. We have a political ruling class to do that.
Congress demanding answers on what caused the economic meltdown.
A bipartisan group of senators known as the Gang of Six is working on a proposal to cut the deficit.
The Congressional Super Committee created to cut the deficit.
The Simpson-Bowles plan.
Senator Coburn's plan.
Doesn't this sound like a great idea? Simpson-Bowles sound like a great idea?
The Bowles-Simpson dead on arrival.
The 10 of you spent months working on this, though, and now you have this significant dissent.
I think what we should do is break these banks up.
To break up every institution right now. Could have been destabilizing.
You haven't put your own budget together.
This,
you're sitting on the sidelines blaming
Obama
others.
Would be fired.
The truth of the matter, Howard, the reason
President Obama
this
fired
administration...
Gentlemen.
I think I got it. Yeah. I think I got it. That's... For God's sakes, people. Now I see why you're mad at them for being muddled and incoherent. That's your job. Although, wait, we did pass Dodd-Frank, the greatest Wall Street reform since the Great Depression.
In just over 2 weeks, the Dodd-Frank law will be a year old, and we're not really any closer to fully implementing it.
The stuff that would have addressed the fraud, too big to fail, derivatives, from almost all those measures were either rejected outright or watered down to almost near meaningless.
Out of an estimated 400 regulations to be written, just 38 are complete.
And those 38 were the easy ones. No spitting. Don't take your out before five on the wall. You know what? If the people who were supposed to fix our financial system had actually done it, the people who have no idea how to solve these problems wouldn't be getting for not offering solutions. And while we all fight, the real victims, as always, continue to suffer.
I was up in Boston this weekend, and they had Occupy Boston. There were 1,000 people at Dewey Square.
You were protesting?
I was just driving by. I was trying to get to supper, and 1,000 people were between me and a steak dinner.
Steve Doocy reacting to the revolution. Let me eat steak. We'll be right back.
By coincidence, I first met with Jacob Hacker and Paul Pearson on the very day Occupy Wall Street had sprung up in Lower Manhattan. And I wondered, as so many others did, were we seeing the advance guard of a movement by organized people to challenge the power of organized money? Well, it's still too soon to know. But in the weeks that followed, every time we went down to the encampment, there was no mistaking the message.
I don't have thousands of dollars to go buy myself a lobbyist to lobby for my views. But corporations do.
Linnea Palmer Patton is 23 and an Occupy Wall Street volunteer.
This is supposed to be a government for the people, you know, run by the people. And if our voices don't matter because we're not wealthy, that's really unacceptable and it's dangerous.
My name is Hero Vincent. I'm 21 years old. I've been here since day one. My parents were foreclosed on. My father's been unemployed a couple years. My mother was the only one taking care of the family for a while. I've been working since I was 14 years old, you know, trying to put food on our table, trying to help out with the bills. And So all these circumstances, my sister's in college and we can barely afford it, you know? And so it brought us here. Like, the struggle brought us to this occupation, this day, this moment.
It ain't no harm to occupy if you're set on freedom. Hallelujah, 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 hallelujah.
Amin Hussein is a former corporate lawyer. He's now an artist who has become one of the many organizers of Occupy Wall Street.
This connection between government and state regulating money and the flow of money at the expense of 99% of the population is untenable, and it's no longer being accepted. And there's been a shift in the way people think of themselves in this political process, that there has been a level of empowerment. But this movement is about transforming society.
All of us who are sleeping at home, we're writing letters, we're thinking about you.
Thank you. I really appreciate it.
We're changing our bank accounts.
My family's home was almost foreclosed in Hackensack, New Jersey. First by Providian Bank, then by Bank of America, then Chase. The names changed. We were almost homeless.
Yesenia Berrigan is working for her doctorate in Latin American history at Columbia University.
We were able to gather enough resources, enough money within our family to save the house. So we like to say that we were the lucky ones. And I'm basically here because I don't want to live in a world where there are lucky ones and unlucky ones.
My name is Daniel Lynch. I live in Manhattan. And in my spare time, I try to trade stocks. Or I might even be center right. And I still support this, and I want people to know that, yeah, right, 99%, exactly, right? I've been worried for a long time about problems with wealth inequality in the country, income inequality, and I just wanted to throw my support a little. I don't march, I don't carry a sign, but I come down at night, I talk to some people. I believe in capitalism, I believe in capital markets, but unchecked like this, especially the way we have estate taxes, income taxes, it subverts capitalism, it becomes feudalism. Owners of capital are winning so much more than laborers, right? Capital is, it has no roots, right? And to just deny that that's happening and not have a little bit of an activist tax policy about it, I think it's naive, it's destructive, and it's absurd.
My name is Nalini Stamp. I'm 24 years old.
Nalini Stamp is a community organizer. She joined Occupy Wall Street on its first day.
I've been fed up with having to worry about living paycheck to paycheck. Because of corporate greed and because we don't have a very high minimum wage in New York, I really just wanted to take a major leap in fighting back. I think that we need to, first of all, have public financing of elections. That is a huge deal. One of the reasons is, you know, why corporations is because there are unlimited amount of donations that they can give to political campaigns. And it's about time we all stand up and take this back.
I found my voice. I've been very apathetic, very cynical of the system that, do I matter? Do I matter to politicians? Do I matter to government when policies are being made?
Tyler Kumbelik volunteered with Occupy's media outreach team.
Personally, I want to see money out of government. I'm a very big proponent of campaign finance reform, of limiting the role of lobbyists and limiting the role of corporate personhood. Because I feel right now who has the largest war chest is the determiner of who's going to be elected for a specific office or what kind of laws are going to be passed by Congress. And that corporatist type of government is not what the United States is supposed to be.
You got a better chance of being an organ donor than seeing any retirement money.
I think this is a perfect kind of forum for us to all come and talk about
back and forth.
Yeah, I've seen many souls changed in the last 3 days.
Really?
Yeah, on all sides, including the other side of the barricade.
See, I went through the Woodstock generation, and I thought it was just back to business as usual. It just sort of, it was a big party. That's what I see this as, a party with no cover. I'm a defender of money, freedom, individual freedom, rich people, because I'm still, even though I got great, I'm still trying to be one. Because the more money I have, the more good I can do. And it'll be my decision as to how I allocate that good, how I allocate that capital. But when I look around at all these buildings, hospitals, colleges, I don't see many poor people's names. They're all rich people. Reverend Ike, a black minister, used to preach up here in New York. He used to say, if you curse the rich, you'll never be one.
I mean, look at the people out here. You think they're out here just hanging out? I mean, that blows my mind that you came out here and you said, well, people out here, you know, they have something against wealthy people. You know, wealthy people should be allowed to be wealthy people because why we're wealthy people will throw money out and sprinkle it on and make people's lives better. It's not happening. Wealthy companies are not making the common person's lives better. They're taking their money, they're moving it abroad, they're doing different things. Yeah, what's that got to do with it?
You got a nice camera, you got clothes, you're blessed.
I just told you that I'm not one of the ones.
I can't be so pessimistic about this.
I'm being realistic. I live in a very nice house, my family's blessed. So I'm not going to pretend that I'm, you know, that I don't have anything. But I do also recognize that a lot of the situations we're in now is because of greed. It's because, it's not what he said, well, you just let people take their money and they'll do good things with it. Not all people do good things with their money.
The 1%
have dominant
political power
over both parties.
Organizers invited Bill Black to lead a teach-in at the People's Microphone.
Okay, how many think they stole from all of us?
A senior federal regulator in the 1980s, Black cracked down on banks during the savings and loan crisis. He now teaches economics and law at the University of Missouri, Kansas City.
What we have is recurrent, intensifying financial crises driven by elite fraud, and now it's done with almost absolute impunity. So the whole idea of noblesse oblige and such, and that the rich were supposed to have special responsibilities, that's all gone, right? They have a God-given right to the lowest conceivable taxes when you put anti-regulators in charge of the agencies who believe that regulation is bad and completely unnecessary. And they destroy it and create a self-fulfilling prophecy that produces massive fraud at the most elite levels, but worse, it all feeds into politics. So once you get a group that completely dominates the economy, they're going to completely dominate politics as well.
There is no excuse.
There is no excuse.
For not prosecuting.
For not prosecuting.
It is an obscenity.
It is an obscenity.
It's surrender.
It's surrender.
To crony capitalism.
To crony capitalism.
What's distressed me, and I think is one of the major reasons we get recurrent intensifying crises, is we seem to have lost our capacity for outrage. And it's only people getting outraged that produces really positive social change.
So much comfort for all of us.
I have a brother who's been out of work for 2 years. He's out of family. I think it's just terrible that they don't care. They're making millions of dollars. I mean, Mitch McConnell is a multimillionaire. John Boehner is a multimillionaire. They don't care about the people. They really don't. And their own districts have many people who are unemployed, who are having foreclosures. And it's time that they stop playing this game and really said, you know, I think maybe we'll pass something that will help build our infrastructure or get people back to work. So this is a start. I hope it makes a dent. The fact that it's not just here, but it's all over the country now, means that somebody's waking up.
Waking up is right. Waking up to the reality that inequality matters. It matters because what we're talking about is what it takes to live a decent life. If you get sick without health coverage, inequality matters. If you're the only breadwinner and out of work, inequality matters. If your local public library closes down and you can't afford to buy books on your own, inequality matters. If budget cuts mean your child has to pay to play on the school basketball team or sing in the chorus or march in the band, inequality matters. If you lose your job as you're about to retire, inequality matters. And if the financial system collapses and knocks the props from beneath your pension, inequality matters. I grew up in a working-class family. We were among the poorest in town, but I was rich in public goods. I went to a good public school, played sandlot ball in a good public park, had access to a good public library, drove down a good public highway to a good public college, all made possible by people I never met. There was an unwritten bargain among the generations. We didn't all get the same deal, but we did get civilization. That bargain's being shredded. The occupiers of Wall Street understand this. You could tell from their slogans. A fellow young enough to be my grandson wore a T-shirt emblazoned with the words, "The system's not broken, it's fixed." That's right, rigged. And that's why so many are so angry. Not at wealth itself, but at the crony capitalists who resort to tricks, loopholes, and hard, cold cash for politicians to make sure insiders prosper and then pull up the ladder behind them. Yes, Americans are waking up to how they're being made to pay for Wall Street's malfeasance and Washington's complicity, paying with stagnant wages and lost jobs, with slashing cuts to their benefits and to their social services. And waking up to the grotesque Supreme Court decision defining a corporation as a person, although it doesn't eat, breathe, make love, or sing, or take care of children and aging parents. Waking up to how campaign contributions corrupt our elections, to the fact that if speech is money, no money means no speech. So the collective cry has gone up, loud and clear, enough's enough. We won't, as I said, know for a while if this is just a momentary cry of pain or whether it's a movement that, like the abolitionists and suffragettes, the populists and workers of another era, or the civil rights movement of our time, gathers force until the powers that be can no longer sustain the inequality, the injustice, and yes, the immorality of winner-take-all politics.
Tell me the story. Let's act like we don't know what all this is. And you're explaining this movement. Do it as you did. You wrote a great article, The Economic Elite Versus the People, and it tells a story. Tell me the story.
Well, it was all about watching the consolidation of wealth happen. You know, Mike, it's been over the past 35 years we've had this massive consolidation of wealth to the point where 1% of the population just really ran away with all the wealth explosion from productivity increases over the past generation, technological advancements. All the wealth generation went straight to the top, to the point where we had 400 people who had as much wealth as half the U.S. population. That's 155 million people. So there's been such a concentration of wealth. And then, you know, the 99% movement was basically, you know, I felt that, you know, 99% of the population has been left out of the political process. And the system has been rigged through campaign finance, lobbying, the revolving door. So the 99% movement was all about uniting people across the political spectrum against global financial interests that have bought control of our government. And, you know, that was the start of it. And, yeah, you know, when the 99% movement was getting rolling online, our site came under attack and we were knocked offline. And from that, we've kind of developed a relationship with various people who go under the banner of Anonymous. You know, Anonymous is also a decentralized movement, mm-hmm. like Occupy Wall Street is. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's various people that go under the Anonymous banner, and they helped us out. And from that, we formed this collaborative effort called A99. And A99 was, you know, putting out these videos calling for protests, calling for the occupation
yeah.
of public space, Occupy Wall Street. On June 14th, as you mentioned, we had our first attempt at occupying Zuccotti Park, which, you know, was a failed attempt.
That was 2011.
Right. This attempt was. Mm-hmm. On that same day, June 14th, though, a very serendipitous thing happened in the fact that the Bloombergville protest, people protesting Bloomberg's budget cuts, Also started on that very same day, June 14th, right by City Hall.
Mm.
And the fact that our first attempt at occupying Zuccotti Park was a failed one allowed us to kind of join forces with the Bloombergville crew.
Was that by happenstance, David? Did that just...
Yeah, total happenstance. You know, we were actually trying to convince the Bloombergville people to set up their camp in, you know, Liberty Park, but they wanted to keep their focus on Bloomberg and the budget cuts, not Wall Street at that point. But then, you know, from that relationship, they were ready to take on Wall Street. And then, of course, Adbusters had the announcement for September 17th. So all those forces kind of rallied together.
Yeah, tell me more about it. You know, people don't get the connection between what Anonymous has done to further this thing either. I mean, you know, every time the mainstream media gets a shot at Anonymous, they take it rather than saying, well, you know, what part did they play in making this such a positive movement?
Oh, man. First of all, they, you know, like I said, they came to our defense and kept us online at a point when, you know, our site was getting attacked and, you know, our hosting company just didn't want to host us anymore because it kept, you know, we had our entire ISP network got taken out, which affected a whole bunch of other sites. So, you know, anonymous people flying under the Anonymous banner helped us out.
Mm.
But they've also put out 3 viral videos that got hundreds of thousands of views and really spread the message online. You know, it's a decentralized resistance movement. They're like freedom fighters.
They are. I mean, truthfully, they're a modern freedom fighter. I don't know how else to. Every time I see the mainstream media take a shot at them, it just angers me so much. People, my God.
The problem is, though, that there could be people who are saboteurs and, you know, they do things in the name of Anonymous that, you know, make it look bad. But, you know, there's other people who defend the, you know, honor of Anonymous, if you can call it that, and fight back against those saboteurs. And in a decentralized movement, you know, I look at Occupy Wall Street as the offline version of Anonymous.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that it's so decentralized. And basically the way the movement works is people who are doing constructive, empowering work and have solid ideas, other people just gravitate towards those ideas, and they become powerful, and they become successful actions.
I think the average reader sees it in bits and pieces. That, you know, they see one part here, you see something going on in Boston, something going on in L.A., but as it is all coming together, even though it's very decentralized, there at least are some common notions about what's coming out of this, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I certainly can't speak for the movement as a whole. No one really can. But, you know, when you look at what is gaining traction and consensus around the country, you know, I see over and over again ending corporate personhood and getting money out of politics. You mm-hmm. know, the whole corporations are not people, money is not speech. Mm-hmm. You know, everyone gets the fact that the political system has been rigged by the elite financial interests.
Do you see that actually gaining enough steam to where we could all vote on this on a constitutional amendment?
I do. I mean, it's not going to be easy, of course, but you know, it really is kind of the underlying driving force in you know, based on my opinion and my perspective and observation of the movement. And I think that, you know, as we move into the spring, you know, everything kind of operates on 3-month cycles. You know, we had the first 3 months where we had, you know, 2,000 occupations blow up, and then, you know, the occupations had, you know, confronted with various First Amendment, you know, violations, and the camps got raided. But now we're in this 3-month process where everyone's regrouping and mm-hmm. having meetings and debating and trying to figure out their place within the movement.
Now, what's the next move, David? What happens next? What do you expect to see next from the Occupy movement?
Well, I think we're going to have another month of, you know, intense debate and strategizing. But once the spring comes, you know, March 30th is going to be a national occupation of D.C. May 1st is going to be a huge general strike. And through the month of May, Chicago is going to be a hot spot for sure with the G8 and the NATO meeting.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, so once the weather gets warm again, you're going to start to see a lot more of the actions on a larger scale. You know, the occupations were great to have, you know, 1,000, 5,000 people to come out. But once the warm weather comes, I'm feeling confident that we're going to have, you know, tens of thousands at actions throughout the country.
How is the media doing covering this movement in America, in your estimation?
Well, the mainstream media is, you know, doing a really poor job, in my opinion, which is, you know, somewhat to be expected. But, you know, there was a, you know, a 2-month span where the media attention really was focused on, you know, random police, you know, conflicts with the police and the raids. We got a lot of coverage through that. But the, you know, the in-depth analysis of why we're doing this is definitely lacking. I mean, it's absurd when you turn on the TV and people say, oh, well, Occupy doesn't have a message. I mean, that's the most absurd thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, sure,
the message, you know, I guess everybody gets their message. The message to me that I hear, David, as I watch all of it, is get money out of politics.
Okay, before I turn it over to audience questions, I just want to talk a little bit about the politics of all this. Despite the extremely large coverage that the Occupy Wall Street movement has gotten from a obviously friendly media that likes to see colorful protesters, particularly in New York and so forth, the real populist surge to date in response to broader economic turmoil and so forth has been on the right, and it's been a rather strange populist movement. I think if William Jennings Bryan could come back, he would be rather puzzled to think that the cross of gold is now being hawked on Glenn Beck's show, or that his populist crowds are calling for a return to the gold standard rather than dumping it. The idea that you have a mass populist movement clamoring for austerity just does not compute with me. And I'm curious why the three of you think that the Tea Party has been the success that it has, and why, in effect, has populism emerged in response to hard times more on the right than on the left to date? And will that be the wave of the future, or will Occupy Wall Street be the start of a sort of left-wing populism that will you know, fill in the gap that has so far existed?
I think there's no question that the Tea Party is astroturf populism. This may have begun as a grassroots movement, but it was very quickly organized and packaged and paid for by interests who wanted to shared goals with the original organizers and participants in the Tea Party movement. So I think to call the Tea Party movement populism in the same way as we describe a sort of genuine, broad-based popular movement, I think is false. That's not to say it's not a significant player in American politics, and it's having a lot of influence inside the Republican Party, and it's influencing public policy, but I don't think it's a genuine populist movement. I think the question for Occupy Wall Street is,
let me query you on that point of information. Do you mean that it's not a genuinely large-based popular movement, or that it's a populist movement with a false consciousness that is following non-populist?
It may or may not be a movement with a false consciousness. That to me is not the important point for this question. I think it's connected to 30 to 40 years of extremely effective organization of the business community and the American right that feeds this lobbying frenzy that George described, and that has resulted in policies that I've already discussed that have helped to skew the income distribution and to skew the distribution of risk across the population. So I think if we think about the Tea Party movement that way, the question for Occupy Wall Street and the question for more recent demonstrations and the emergence of an apparent movement on the left is, can it kind of find the same kind of organizational infrastructure that will allow it to play a similar role in American politics. I haven't quite seen that yet. I mean, George has probably spent more time observing it more closely than I have. I think the most interesting aspect of one of the most interesting aspects of Occupy Wall Street has been the labor movements beginning to sit up and pay attention and get itself involved. And I wonder if that's a potential sort of marriage that might catapult Occupy Wall Street into something bigger.
Yeah, it's if you're counting on Occupy Wall Street to somehow get its act together and elect the next president, you're going to be disappointed because from what I've seen, it's an endless series of meetings about meetings and about the way
The Tea Party isn't going to elect the next president either.
They won't, but they did elect the last Congress.
That's true.
Which was quite an achievement. I do think the Tea Party was an overrated phenomenon that is already receding. It was a reaction to the bailouts and to Obama. It was not a reaction to financial hard times.
So what about Obama? Do you have something in mind when you say that?
Well, let me think.
Because people have made the argument
maybe,
that there's a racist component.
There is a racist component, and there is a xenophobic component, and there is a component of people who see the world changing in ways that are alien and unsettling to them. And so it is largely small town and rural. It's not working poor. It's very much the middle class, the self-employed businessman, and it's a reactionary movement in the true sense of that word. It's not the political future of the country because demographically that group is not the political future of the country, but it organized itself beyond almost anybody's imaginings last year with the great help of a lot of money. I remember driving around the Danville-Martinsville area of Virginia during the midterm elections last year and seeing these big black billboards that said, November is coming. November is coming. It had this kind of eerie, like the space aliens are going to be landing soon. And at the bottom in small letters, it said, Americans for Prosperity. That is the Koch brothers. So Martinsville and Danville voted for Republican, but they also had a ton of money poured in by the interests that you talked about. So why hasn't there been a movement of the foreclosed or the unemployed? I've been asking myself that question for the last few years. In the 30s, we saw that. We don't see that now, or maybe we see little glimmers of it. I think what we're dealing with is the result of a long process in which their institutions have faded, labor unions primary among them, institutions that are going to speak to issues like economic inequality, and counter-institutions in Washington and in business and in the media have grown very powerful, so that Barack Obama had about a week before the wind, you know, this tremendous tsunami of opposition sort of got itself back together again after the wipeout in the 2008 elections. It's just there is more organization, there is more money, and there is better, I would say there's better politics in a sense on that side. There's better rhetoric. There's better, in a sense, there's a better use of language for achieving political ends. There's William F. Buckley said, you know, rhetoric is most of politics, and it's something Barack Obama hasn't understood and his opponents have. So there's a lot of reasons that go back several decades for why it's so much harder to organize the bottom fifth than it is to organize business owners and their conservative allies, and that's what we've seen in the last couple of years.
Gary, do you have any thoughts on the politics of all this?
I think the where the Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party come together is that they're both deeply populist movements which are pointing to some kind of evil force, which doesn't require Americans to think about, you know, their own lives and what needs to be done seriously in this country to deal with a relative decline, relative not only to China, but to other countries as well, like Canada. Canada is doing much better than we are. Australia is doing better. So what are those kind of pogo moments that occur to me, which, you know, it's not the kind of thing that the Tea Party can use to get money, or the Occupy Wall Street can get to rally their troops. But let's start with them. Infrastructure. And these have been mentioned by my colleagues, some of them have. Infrastructure. We rate very poorly, between 20th and 30th place, amongst a group of countries, advanced countries in infrastructure, whether you talk railways, roads, airports, ports. And it's not that we're low, but we've been dropping over the last, this 30-year period. So now we're behind Malaysia. We're behind Taiwan on many of these things. It's not only that we're behind Singapore. Yeah, everybody knows that Singapore and Switzerland do it well, but we're behind a lot of countries which you wouldn't think of as being tops in infrastructure, Estonia. Next, education. Well, I think that's more broadly known than the infrastructure story, but it is discouraging that, again, we're down 17th place, 20th place, math, below 30th place in a range of countries, and that goes beyond Shanghai, and we know that Shanghai really works hard on their math and so forth, but there are a lot of countries which don't have that same intensity of purpose that, let's say, Shanghai, China does, but are doing far better, and we are kind of sinking on the educational front. You could toss that in with immigration, because we no longer are very welcoming to highly skilled people from abroad, many of whom would love to come to our country, but we're not don't have the open arms that we once did. Next, and I hope I don't offend anybody here, but our health is not good. The percentage of overweight has doubled. It's now over 50% of the population. Obesity has more than doubled. It's over 30% of the population. And this is bad for the people. I think it has to tell on their people's ability to perform in the workplace. It certainly tells in health statistics. The average obese person requires 30% more health expenditure for the adult than the person who's normal weight. I mean, these are bad statistics, and we're much worse than other countries on that too as well. Okay, now let's come to the deficit, where what we have in this country is a population which really wants European-style entitlement programs, and they have been, to a large extent, enacted, and the trajectory going forward is up and up, as everyone, I think, knows, both on Medicare and Social Security and related entitlement programs. But we don't want to pay the money for it. Every other country which has this kind of social programs, and fair enough, we want it, we need to pay for it, they have national consumption taxes, value-added taxes, or different names, goods and services taxes, but they pay for it. We don't pay for it. We don't want to pay for it, so naturally we have a deficit, which is not just the kind of recession of the moment and hard times of the moment, but it's structural, it's big. Congress is talking about it, super committee, whether they'll do anything about it, I don't know, but those are serious problems. Now, do you hear any of that from either the Tea Party? Not very much. Occupy Wall Street? Not at all.
Higher taxes to fund education, infrastructure, and public health programs. Gary, you've just outlined the new progressive populist agenda.
For tonight's Conversations with Great Minds, I'm joined by award-winning journalist, syndicated columnist, and internationally best-selling author, Naomi Klein. Naomi Klein is a contributing editor for Harper's and a reporter for Rolling Stone, writes a regular column for The Nation and The Guardian, but is also syndicated internationally. Her writing has appeared in dozens of other major newspapers, including The New York Times, The Washington Post, Newsweek, and The Los Angeles Times. In 2004, her reporting from Iraq for Harper's Magazine earned her the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism. She is a former Miliband Fellow at the London School of Economics and holds an honorary doctorate of civil laws from the University of King's College in Canada. In 2007, her book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, became a number one international bestseller. It has now been published in 30 languages with over 1 million copies in print. Her first book, No Logo, Taking Aim at the Brand Bullies, was published in 1999 and was also an international bestseller. The New York Times called it a movement Bible. Time magazine named it as one of the top 100 nonfiction books published since 1923, and the Literary Review of Canada has named it as one of the most as one of the 100 most important Canadian books ever published. I'm very pleased to welcome Naomi Klein to our New York City studio and this edition of Conversations with Great Minds. Naomi, welcome.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us. You've said that the image that ultimately caused you to join the Occupy Wall Street movement protest was a photograph of a young woman holding up a handmade sign that said, "I care about you." You call this a radical act. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, I found it very moving. There was actually another sign that was part of the same photo essay that I was looking at of somebody else holding up a sign that said compassion is a radical act, and I was really moved by it in large part because I'm increasingly convinced that all of the change that we want, and we talk about, you know, what are your demands, and you know, it might be universal health care, or it might be free public education, that none of this is going to happen unless we really shift the underlying values of our culture, and particularly American culture. And the idea that these young people would be holding up signs that say, "I care about you," on Wall Street. It is such a radical act because you think about what this culture teaches us to do, and it really is to not care about each other, to harden our hearts to each other, to not look at the homeless on the street, or, you know, at the extreme end, to shout, "Let them die," at a Republican a presidential debate when a question is raised about what to do about somebody who hasn't purchased health care insurance. These are the types of values that govern this culture, that make the sorts of excesses that people are protesting possible. So that's why I was so moved by that sign of just somebody holding up a sign that said, "I care about you." And as I talk to people at the protest camp at Occupy Wall Street at Liberty Plaza, you know, I often hear stories about what's drawing people there, why are they there, and they talk about people coming up to them on the street. And I met a young woman who told a story about how a man came up to her on the street and said, "I love you," and she was completely taken aback by this, but then she just realized, you know, well, maybe that's not so bad. So she told him she loved him too. That's the kind of thing happening in New York right now. It's a very odd moment.
Do you think it might be I suspect this is something probably Canadians are far more aware of than Americans, because the Indigenous rights movement in Canada has been so well established over at least the last few decades, and so well publicized, with the change of the Northwest Territories and all that other thing, and the idea of decisions being made in a circle by consensus by an actual governmental body, which doesn't exist anywhere in the United States but does in a province in Canada, and we're seeing that kind of thing, and almost a potlatch culture morality out of it, which again I think most Americans are unfamiliar with, and most Canadians probably are, happening.
Yeah.
I don't know if
most Canadians are. I mean, I don't think most Canadians are familiar with this kind of gift economy that you see down there.
Yeah.
And that is so radical, the idea of just freely giving each other health care, freely feeding one another, and nothing is asked in return. And, you know, that is if you think about this generation of young people who have grown up, you know, at the absolute peak of consumerism, and everything is about consumption and buying and selling. And people are just in love with the idea of a space that is decommodified. I think there is a difference in Canada. And this is where it's sort of like, how do you change the values of a culture? It's tricky because, you know, in Canada, we do have public health care. We do have universal health care. And I've always felt that changes the character of our country. You know, the fact that we don't have to, as Canadians, develop a rationale for why we let people die if they don't have the money to pay for their health care. That makes us, I think, somewhat of a, you know, a more compassionate people in some way. So, yeah, it's tricky because once when you bring in policies that universalize education, that universalize healthcare, people change. Their values change as well. So maybe that's how you do change the values of a culture.
I think you've nailed it. In shock doctrine, you talk about disaster capitalism, how capitalists seize on disasters to reinvent institutions and the world to their favor. And I'm curious, this is kind of a two-part question here for you. First, we just saw a bank nationalized by France and Belgium. You know, this whole mess that's happening in Europe. I'm curious your thoughts on that. But also, and this may even segue out of that, at least for Europe and hopefully here. Doesn't history also show the reverse, that, for example, FDR seized on the disaster of the Republican Great Depression to create a strong social safety net and guarantee the right to unionize? And if so, might this crisis equally backfire on the disaster capitalists?
It could well. And, you know, in the shock doctrine, I am very clear about the fact that what is wrong with this tactic as practiced by right-wing ideologues is not that they respond decisively to a disaster with profound policy changes, because of course a crisis is usually some kind of a message. I mean, there are some crises that are just like an earthquake and, you know, it doesn't mean anything, it just happened, although a society might be more vulnerable to the effects of that earthquake if they've neglected the public sphere. But if you're talking about an economic crisis or you're talking about disasters linked to climate change, These disasters, these crises are telling us there's something broken in the system. You should fix it. You should respond. What is sinister about what I describe in the shock doctrine is using crises to push through policies that the vast majority of people oppose, often policies that are the exact opposite of what people voted for, and just using the chaos and the panic to push through these measures under the guise of sort of emergency measures. But what's interesting about the tactic is exactly what you say, Tom, that really what we've seen is a strategy develop on the right in response to the understanding that if you don't have this right-wing shock doctrine strategy, particularly an economic crisis will be an opportunity for progressives. And of course, the case in point is the New Deal. This was studied very closely. And you know, if we understand what the phase of capitalism that we've been living through, of deregulated privatization, you know, what is often called neoliberalism, this whole phase of capitalism is a revolt of the elites against the gains of the New Deal. Undoing those gains. So a huge amount of study has gone into to trying to figure out how to prevent a repeat of that. And that's why you have all of these think tanks that are ready and waiting with their policies, no matter what the crisis is, to push it through. And so this economic crisis, despite the fact that it was created by deregulated capitalism, the solution that ends up getting proposed to pay the bill for this crisis is more deregulation, more tax cuts for the rich. It makes absolutely no sense. That's the shock doctrine. That's disaster capitalism. What's happening on the streets of New York and in cities around the world is people demanding what they actually voted for, and demanding a firm response to real crises that actually gets at the underlying issues that caused the crisis. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. Not only is there nothing wrong with it, we desperately need it.
Well, and speaking to what people voted for in here in the United States in 2008, President Obama, one of the speeches he gave just 4 days before his election was, you know, you stand with me and I will fundamentally change America and we will fundamentally change the world. That's a revolutionary call. It's not the kind of call that you would expect to hear from a Republican running or even a Democrat in times of stability. And
well, I mean, people often forget that the core debate, right, the real standoff, turning point in the 2008 election was when McCain said the fundamentals of the economy are strong, right? And that, and Obama said, no, they're not. So of course, as you say, he was elected to implement fundamental change, and he didn't. And that's why people have taken to the streets and gone to the locations, the symbols of financial power that people understand has been the blockade to that kind of change.
Thoughts on where he may be going or where the American political process may going, be going as a consequence of this, shall we call it charitably, a missed opportunity?
Well, I think, you know, where it's gone is into the streets. And this to me is a tremendous source of hope, because my fear about the Obama presidency, one of my greatest fears about the Obama presidency was that the young people who really were the heart and soul of his campaign in 2008, who knocked on doors and slept on floors, and who got into politics for the first time because they were inspired by the type of rhetoric that you were just quoting, and they believed that this was going to be fundamental change. And of course, one of the issues that most energized young people was climate change, because this is their future. And then when nothing happened in so many areas, and particularly in environmental regulation, but also in job creation and student indebtedness and the ability to afford education, and so what I was afraid of is that this generation would just go back, you know, to their homes and decide that politics is just for losers and disengage, because of course there have been many generations of young people who've disengaged from politics in this country. And that's what's so hopeful about this moment, is that rather than disengaging and lapsing into cynicism or nihilism, you have a generation that's learning from their experience and going, okay, we see that the system has some fundamental flaws. Even if the president isn't interested in fixing those flaws, we're going to get to work fixing them. And so you have all kinds of debates about what are the structural problems, money in politics, the fact that corporations are treated as persons under the law. These are the types of debates that are happening down at Occupy Wall Street. And I think we're going to start to see some very radical demands come out of this movement. It just takes a while to have a democratic process that can articulate those demands. But I don't think that, you know, some people have talked about how this is sort of, you know, a left-wing Tea Party, or that they're just going to be kind of the sort of street heat for the Washington policy wonks who have ideas for how to tinker with the system. I don't think that this wave of demonstrations and outrage is going to be satisfied with only being that. I think that they're going to want to articulate their vision for a better world. And I hope they do, because they deserve that.
A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Brother Barry Mendez. Welcome to this episode of the Class 4 Battlefield Podcast. Occupy Wall Street. Donald K. Trump. There's a connection, ladies and gentlemen. There's a huge connection. It is time that we stop pretending, one, that it was accidental that big media, MSNBC, CNN, Fox News, CBS, all of them, gave Donald Trump a lot of free coverage. We have to stop believing that that was coincidental, that it was accidental. I don't care how many times they go on to their own networks and say it. You heard me. I said their own networks and say it because that's what they're doing. It just wasn't true. They knew what they were doing. In 2016, I was following online the coverage of the rallies. And I was talking to a man who is a computer engineer and very highly skilled with engineering. Not engineering computers, but he knows his way around networks and the rest. And we were talking in, I think it was February and March, about Donald Trump versus Hillary Clinton. And I said to him, I go, what I don't understand, and I really don't get this, is that the media is covering Donald Trump when he has 2,000 or 3,000 or 4,000 people, or 10,000 sometimes. But they won't cover Bernie Sanders, who has 5,000 and 6,000 and 10,000 and 12,000 and 20,000 and 30,000 people at his rallies. And obviously I said, you know, it was the socialist aspect. And I've made this statement here before, so that's nothing new to you. But ladies and gentlemen, the reason why I did this little retrospective for Occupy Wall Street, and this will not be the first one I do, or should I say the last one I do, it will be the first one I do, is because I don't believe that most people are making the connection between something that happened 8 years ago and something that is going on now, or something that happened in 2016, which is Donald Trump's election. Forgiving that Clinton might have been a flawed candidate, that the media has been attacking her since the 1990s, poisoning a generation's mind on who she is, by the way, because we don't talk about the power of that. And forgiving the fact that I keep arguing differently, that they were concerned about her and they would have picked Donald Trump over her. You always look at what they're doing. Forgiving all of that, why would they choose Donald Trump, knowing he was the person who he was? Donald Trump is not a successful businessman. He has never been a successful businessman. His success has come from spending money and then getting more money to spend and then just keeping that credit line open. Donald Trump is really a good representation of those people that we call very, very wealthy. A lot of them really owe a lot of money. And I remember Gary Null talking about this. He did an interview with Chris Hedges early this year. I apologize. It seems like a few years ago. And he was the first one to really come out with this. He said that a lot of the people who we would consider rich, you know, people who have millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, aren't as rich as people think. They are very much in debt, and that their wealth comes from them taking out large sums of money. Donald Trump, outside of the fact that he just wasn't a good businessman, what he was good at was following directions. That's why he kept getting money
I'm not talking legitimate money now. You know, they smear him a lot because, oh, well, he got money from the Russians. Who cares? A lot of people in this country get money from the Russians, and probably are some of those people that they're getting money from are mobbed up in Russia. A lot of people get money from Saudi Arabia, and we know what they do over there. A lot of these people get money from dictators and persons from all over the world that are connected to death squads and have no problem executing men, women, and children, which, by the way, if you know anything about the mob code, one of the primary reasons why they didn't go after innocent women and children was because that was supposed to bring major hexes and curses and what have you onto your home and onto your family and onto the people who are around your family. In other words, the whole organization. And it would supposedly tear apart what you had built. I keep your eye on that one. But Donald Trump was able to get money because anytime when he would get the money, he'd be asked to do things and he would follow through and he would do them. No matter how crazy, no matter how ridiculous, no matter how whatever they were, he would still do them. Sometimes they would, you know, would involve buying other companies, sacking half of the people, you know, what have you. He'd do it. It didn't matter to him. He was a businessman. It was about remaining rich to him. They knew if they got Donald Trump, he wouldn't care about public opinion. He wouldn't care about the injury he caused. He would just do as he was told. The problem with Democrats is whether it's Hillary Clinton, Barack Obama, John Edwards, even John Kerry, or Al Gore, is these people could think. And they did, more or less, pay attention to the winds of public opinion. They could, a lot of people like to beat up Barack Obama about the things that he did, and, oh, well, he's no different than George Bush. Actually, he was very different than George Bush. I'm going to do my best not to go deep into that because it's not as important. But they could only push a person like Barack Obama so far. I mean, they wore him down, especially as he entered his second term. But they wore him down. A lot of people don't understand. People don't really get the power structure in this country. They don't understand it. A book that I really highly recommend to everybody is Friendly Fascism. That is a book that you should be reading once a year from 7th grade, maybe even 6th grade, to 12th grade, and then beyond. And maybe even the American establishment, but I can't remember who wrote that book. People don't understand that there's a bunch of individuals who are very, very wealthy that you don't ever hear about them. Their names are somewhat known, but they're not very well known, and some of them don't even appear on the Forbes 500. Barack Obama did not work for the people. He worked not even for those who gave him donations. He worked for this other group of people. And there are specific promises that are made to each president by this group of people on what they could accomplish. There are specific promises made on what they could accomplish. That's this whole idea of the national agenda. The national agenda isn't set by the President of the United States. It's not set by the Congress. It's set by this group of people. And they set it through an organization of non-governmental agencies and non-for-profit foundations, and then, you know, just by their name, basically. And so who is elected, sometimes who is selected, is given this list of things that they got to do, and then a list of things that, you know, hey, if there's time, we should really try to do some of these things. Try is the operative word. But there's a vision that they want to create. Now, the problem with this vision is it is structured by whomever is presently a part of that group. This group, it appears, is under heavy duress because there's an influx of individuals coming in. And there's a fight that has been really evolving since the Great Depression. Because a lot of them have some financial issues, but most of them are pretty stable financially, it appears. However, the society isn't financially stable. And I'm talking on all levels now. I'm talking about government debt at the federal level, government debt at state level, government debt at the local level, municipal level, and then individual debt. As well as business, big business, especially those who are operating the business side of this equation. And it is an equation, ladies and gentlemen. Look up the word equation and don't take the one that is about math. The one that you most know, but look it up. The people who are on the business side aren't holding up their end of the bargain. They're supposed to be creating all these jobs, and they're not. And that's creating strong discontent among the lower classes. So you have a fight that's ensuing about how do we go forward and how do we release this pressure? The ascending side, apparently, is very, 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 very conservative in what they want to do. And they draw their inspiration not from 1930 or 1920, but from 1820 and 1930. This is why you have Donald Trump suddenly dropping the hint about wanting to buy Greenland. I really do not know if the channels, the back channels, had made it clear that Donald Trump wanted and the United States wanted to buy Greenland. But you better believe that this is something that has been discussed at a high level of the society. In other words, there is a group of wealthy people who looked at Greenland and said, we need it. We want it. And Donald Trump said, okay, let's do it. The reason they wanted it, they said it was very clear, and a lot of people dismiss this, is because of the natural resources. Well, why do you want, if what conservatives have been saying for the longest time, which is that the United States has enough natural resources to do whatever the heck we want, why is it then that you need Greenland? One, because, yeah, the ice sheet is melting, but two, because the United States doesn't have that much natural resource, or that many natural resources left, and, this is very important. Oh, this is really important, and this is the one that very few people, nobody actually talked about. when you have this much discontent at home, and I mean this, there's a lot of social discontent. One of the cures of that discontent, which was utilized in the 1820s and the 1830s, and really up until present day, up until maybe the 1950s, you can use this. You just move them to non-incorporated, non-organized land. In other words, you'd move them to a colony. If the United States was capable of buying Greenland, they would start massive, massive transformation of the island and moving groups of people from the United States to Greenland. Not only to work the land, but to kind of ease the social tension, because the United States is becoming increasingly a brown country. Most of the people who'd want to go to Greenland are going to be white, and that would kind of ease the tension of the growing number of brown and black people and the non-brown and black people, the white people, by moving them to another place where then they can prosper. There's a lot going on in this that a lot of people just aren't understanding. There is a segment of the elite that want imperialism to come back. They want it to come back. There's a group within the elite that always wanted, for instance, the United States to control all of Mexico. The United States during the Mexican-American War marched on and captured Mexico City. The old rules of war was, once you captured a city, once especially the capital, you kept the country. The South, the southern states of the United States, wanted the United States to absorb all of Mexico. The North did not. And I could see why not. It made sense. If the United States had absorbed all of Mexico, that would have put it, of course, south of the Mason-Dixon, and it would have made it ripe for slave exploitation. That would have then added tremendous power to the South, which was already in a position of tremendous power anyway. We are seeing that what many people thought was dead, but I can't remember. There was an African scholar who wrote a book on it, which a lot of people thought imperialism was dead. He wrote a book where he said, no, imperialism just has transformed. This long-held belief of conquering lands is still in the DNA of the United States of America. And you are seeing a group of individuals in the elite exercise that power. Now, I want you to really think about this, because if Hillary Clinton was the president of the United States, and trust me, there is financial reasons that the United States is pushing to grab Greenland. There are financial reasons. There's a lot of oil. There's a lot of natural resources that these companies are licking their lips over. Because China is out maneuvering the United States of America in Africa, because the U.S. is stingy. It doesn't want to actually help Africans build anything. So the Africans are going to China, and China is working hard to help Africans build up infrastructure so they can then exploit the land. I always tell people, though, China is just a couple of steps away from the United States of being really heavy-handed. So I'm waiting to see how long that lasts. My belief is, before I'm 60, that grand alliance between China and Africa is going to show a lot of cracks, especially when Africa starts moving towards rapid self-determination. and they have issues with certain things that the Chinese are doing, we're going to see about that. But if Hillary Clinton was president, there'd be no way that she'd go for this whole idea of let's buy Greenland. It wouldn't happen. It would not happen. There was a rumor back in the late 90s. I remember reading about it too on the, wow, can't believe that was the internet back then, but it was the internet, that there was this rumor that there was some talk because of how many people were trying to get into the United States from Mexico of the U.S. purchasing, I don't know how true it was, purchasing several border states of the of Mexico. Just saying, to hell with it, we're going to purchase them, and then annex those lands. There was 10 of them, I think, on the list. This was 97, 98. Anyway, and then the U.S. was supposed to go in and you know, chase out the drug cartels, basically with the military, and then just make them all part of the United States. I don't know how true that was. I really don't. But if it was true, because as soon as I heard this thing about Greenland, my mind automatically went back to that. The reason why I probably didn't get off the ground is because, well, one, Bill Clinton was going through what he was going through, but also, Bill Clinton probably looked around and said, no, this is illegal. This is not right. This is non-constitutional. We're not doing this anymore. We're not annexing lands. Donald Trump is different. Donald Trump doesn't care. Now, outside of this, because that was important, as I was, this obviously is part of, again, the national strategy that's being formed by these wealthy people. But when it comes to Donald and Occupy, you have to see a clear-cut path from Occupy Wall Street to Donald Trump. Because Barack Obama's hands were kind of tied by Occupy Wall Street in 2012. Don't forget, it changed. Occupy Wall Street changed the conversation in the election year. Income inequality became a topic that had to be discussed. Even Mitt Romney had to go back and start talking about income inequality. It changed the metrics of the 2012 election. People had to then start talking about what were you going to do to alleviate this debt crisis that has been afflicting young people and tearing apart communities. And all of this wasn't on the agenda until Occupy Wall Street. So this kind of, this handcuffed Barack Obama, because if the wealthy wanted him to really go out there and just cut regulation, which he still did, but he couldn't be so brazen about it, which was very different than early in his first term. In his first term, he just went out and was basically, you know, their hatchet man. And they knew it. And this is what actually sparked Occupy Wall Street. So they weren't able to get some of the things that they really, really wanted. He made permanent the Bush tax cuts, but refused to give any more tax cuts. Significant tax cuts, should I say. He gave away the House when Obamacare passed. And what I mean by gave away the House was he sunk a lot of money. He gave a lot of federal money to the healthcare industry. He did. And by the way, for those of you who don't know, this all was planned for years, man. They have been positioning themselves to take advantage of some highly subsidized government system that didn't put constraints on their profitability for quite some time. They have been doing mergers in the healthcare industry since the late 80s, and they were on steroids through the 90s. They were on steroids through the 90s, and then they've just been waiting. And Barack Obama did it, because it wasn't something that, you know, Bush could do, but Barack Obama could do it. So he gave them the house when he did that, though. And they were very, very happy about it. The only thing was, he put in there that they had to cover people with pre-existing conditions. They did not like that. He put in there that they couldn't drop people once when they needed their health care. They didn't like that. He put in there some price controls. They did not like that, because these people are greedy and have no conscience. Let's be frank about that. And so they understood, as his second term evolved, that there were just places that he would not ideologically go. They not only understood that, and honest to God, people, look at who Barack Obama ran against in 2012 and tell me if that man isn't just a more competent version of Donald Trump. They're both consciousness. They're both hatchet men. They'll both destroy communities for money. The only difference is one's a rambling buffoon and the other one is not. The wealthy knew that there were limits to where Barack Obama would go, and they also knew there was going to be limits to where Hillary Clinton would go. They also knew that Hillary Clinton was smart. And that was the problem. The things that they've been wanting to do, which, look, you can only do with an autocrat. You can only do with an autocrat. You needed somebody who was going to be able to come in. And if you wanted a huge tax cut, you couldn't do that with a Democrat. You couldn't even do it with a Republican. You would have to slowly do it with a Republican. So you needed an autocrat. You needed someone who was just going to come in and say, to hell with convention, to hell with what you think, to hell with what you say, I'm cutting you all if you come too close to me. And that's what they got with Mr. Trump. There's a narrative which is going around now, and I remember Jimmy Dore talking about it, and I actually don't agree with the narrative. I don't believe that this is true. Jimmy Dore says, and again, I get that other people have made the statement, but this is it. He was the first one I heard that said it, and he's the one I've heard him say it repeatedly, and it's kind of went out from him to other people. He said that if Hillary Clinton had won, a lot of the conversations that we are having, we wouldn't be having. And I don't believe that. I do not believe that. And the reason I don't believe it is because, one, Occupy Wall Street didn't happen when George Bush was in office. Two, people were actually, and maybe it was because it was a generational lull, which is absolutely possible, people were kind of shell-shocked with George Bush. They didn't know how to take him and how to approach him, even though, you know, there was huge anti-war protests, there were some environmental protests. They still didn't react in a very negative, overtly negative tone to him. Especially when he didn't do what people wanted him to do. They just said, he's a Bush, he's a Republican, he's a conservative, and he just doesn't care about what, you know, non-conservatives think. But with Barack Obama, Bill Clinton had said that Barack Obama was everyone's cool black friend. And he caught a lot of flack for that. And I think there's a little truth to that. That Barack Obama was seen as having Negro magic. That he was going to come in and he was just going to be so strong and so powerful and so dedicated to the principles of a person like Martin Luther King, even though he didn't look like Martin Luther King, that he was just going to destroy convention to make sure that what was right got done. And everyone believed it. The problem was he wasn't that person. And he, by empowering people, and I think Barack Obama did this on purpose, he really pushed the narrative that it was going to be people power that changed the country. And by doing that, people believed it. And they got active during his administration. And it was during that activity that Occupy Wall Street formed. With Hillary Clinton, if she had won, if she had become the president, I really do believe that you would have seen massive, massive action. Because if you look at how activity was building in the Obama administration, it wasn't going to cease with Hillary Clinton. It wasn't going to cease. And the thing about Hillary Clinton, and I keep pointing this out, people don't like it, they don't want to admit it, they just want to ignore it, I don't care. Hillary Clinton isn't stupid. Hillary Clinton is a type of person that plays for the ages. In other words, how is she going to be remembered? That's why she pushed so hard to become the first female president. She was playing for the ages. And if she had been president and there was this mass, huge movement, and it was sustained for any number of reasons, Hillary Clinton was going to go with that mass movement. She was not going to go for the wealthy. And that was their fear, that was their belief, and that's why they went towards Donald Trump. With Occupy Wall Street specifically, and I make this statement, I've made it a few times, I'll keep making it because it's the truth, and we really need to be thinking about organizing another Occupy movement. Because we're much, much more mature in this now. Occupy Wall Street spread so quickly, mobilized so fast, that the wealthy realized they had a problem. And that problem was that people may have been somewhat complacent, but they weren't dead. They knew the truth. They knew that things were bad. They knew that they were getting screwed. And they knew that things were not going to get better unless people got active. That part right there, that last part right there, that things would only change if people got active, scared the hell. Scared the hell right out of them. Took them right down. They knew they had to do something. Donald Trump started planning to become president of the United States, supposedly, in 2012. A lot of people attribute it to something that Barack Obama said. I don't believe that. I believe that the wealthy started shopping, as usual, for candidates in 2012. Not to run in 2012. But to run in 2016, because it looked like Barack Obama was going to win, even with Mitt Romney. It looked like Barack Obama was going to win. And that Donald Trump, in one of his little get-togethers with the conservative Democrats and the Republicans, said, you know what you need? You need someone who's just going to go in there and not give a damn and just bust heads and do this, this, and this, and that's how you're going to get things done. And there were some that were against it, and there were some that said, well, you know, who can we get for that? And Donald Trump said, me. And it was a joke. It was a joke. But he pulled it out in 2016 and said, I'm going to do this. It's going to be a joke. It's going to be whatever. It's going to raise my stature. I'm not going to win. I'm going to make a lot of money doing it. That seems to be what was apparent from Michael Moore's, from his documentary. Because, you know, I found this out. I didn't know this. But if you make a whole bunch of money trying to run for president and you don't get the nomination, or you don't win, you realize you get to keep all that money. So if you raise $300 million and you only spend $50, you're $250 million richer. A person like Donald Trump, who supposedly has all this money, if he runs for president and he gathers $800, $900 million, and he only spends $100 million, he has $700, $800 million left. A person like Hillary Clinton walked away with over $1 billion from running for president. Or at least those are the numbers that I've seen bantered about. Maybe it's less than that. But he suggested it. And it's his actions that suggest that he knew somewhat what he was doing. He trademarked, if I'm not mistaken, Make America Great Again in 2012. He trademarked it. Okay, why would you trademark it? Unless he was going to loan it to the Republican Party. What I really believe happened was in 2012, he went and he shopped his services. He said to the Republicans, he said to the Democrats, I'll come in. I'll do it, whatever. Here's what I'm going to do. The Democrats looked at him and laughed at him and said, yeah, you're not, no. And he went to the Republicans, and the Republicans said, yeah, no, because you're not going to win, yada, yada, yada. But the wealthy, see, it's two different groups of people you're talking to now. You're talking about the party operatives, and you're talking about the wealthy people who are very wealthy, who operate the national agenda. One group said, yeah, no, not going to happen. And the other group said, we're not really for it, but let's see how this is going to turn out. And you could tell that the wealthy wanted that because, you know, again, using their media platform, they gave him tons and tons of advertisement. And the primary reason, again, I assert, why they were open to it was because of Occupy Wall Street. Because, look, Donald Trump was not a fan of Occupy Wall Street. He wasn't. And Lord knows what he said behind closed doors about Occupy Wall Street and how it should be handled and how the protesters should be handled. Now, mind you, Occupy Wall Street came on the heels of WikiLeaks and what was happening with WikiLeaks. It would then be followed by the creation of Black Lives Matter, the rise of independent progressive media, a push towards the left, a increase in chatter about socialism in a positive light. Bernie Sanders, people often forget about this too. I don't even know if you can get it anymore. Remember he did that, I don't remember how many hours it was. He did a filibuster where he talked in the Senate for a very long time and just talked about income inequality and all this other stuff. And it was all for show. It was all for show because it didn't stop whatever bill it was that he was opposing from getting passed. But it really put him on a national spotlight. And people started researching democratic socialism. They started researching socialism in the 2008 election because the Republicans and the conservatives kept calling Barack Obama a socialist. And from data mining, the wealthy were able to tell that people were not seeing socialism in a negative light. They were seeing it in a positive light. Well, how do you sidestep socialism? Well, logically, what I would say is, if you're going to sidestep socialism, then you have to make capitalism work for everybody. The problem is, capitalism is running out of steam. I was watching a lecture from a German economist. See what I spend my time doing, ladies and gentlemen? But from a German economist, and he was talking about capitalism. And he was talking about how capitalism has gotten to a point where it's proven to be very unmanageable. And there is going to have to be significant adjustments and changes to what is perceived to be capitalism in order to make it viable for the future. Or else it's going to turn into something interesting. He didn't say that. I'm saying that. Because capitalism really does. It evolves into, you know, one of two ways. It either goes very heavy-handedly corporatist, where the corporations control everything. We saw this back in the late 1800s, the early 1900s. Or it evolves into what Germany and England and Spain and others are utilizing as capitalism, which is a heavy participation of unions in order to counter the massive, massive psychopathic leaning on wealth of the merchants and the wealthy classes. You need that unionization. You need that grassroots intervention to make this stuff work. If you don't have it, then, well, like, you know, it goes the other way. These people knew that everyone was looking at socialism good in a positive light, and they also knew that they couldn't stop it. Because, again, I keep reminding you, ladies and gentlemen, from 1998 to 2002, when they would take generational polling and they would look at the new millennial generation, they would discover that the millennials, those who were just graduating at that time, I was among them, by the way, were very left-leaning. These are people, by the way, who weren't raised with a lot of socialistic nonsense in front of them. They weren't raised in pro-union homes. They were raised in homes where the Soviet Union was discussed as a negative, and yet there was still a positive connotation about purely socialistic concepts. And maybe that's the point, is when you break it down and you don't ideologically assign the concepts of socialism to socialism, people are for it. You look at people and you say, you pay for health care. Why is it? Well, you pay for it anyway in your taxes for other people. You pay for it when you overpay for, you know, medicine and what have you. Why then, shouldn't you have it for free? But those are all different things. That's kind of one of the things it's a passion for me. They seen this, and they needed somebody to go in and turn the tide of history, or try to anyway. Because Occupy Wall Street absolutely was socialist-inspired. It wasn't socialist-inspired because there were socialists from, I don't know, some country, which Fox News would probably have to pick, you know, intervening in the United States. It was socialist because socialism literally is the people acting socially to construct new instruments of community and togetherness and bonding, which is something that big corporations don't want to happen. If you wanted to stop that mindset from coming to the White House, which was being pushed by Occupy, if you wanted to stop that, who would you send? You would send somebody who doesn't care about public opinion, who is an autocrat. And that, my friends, is why we have Donald Trump. That's why. Pure and simple. When I was doing the research for this, because let me kind of explain why I did this episode. When I was doing research for this, I forgot how uniformly against Occupy Wall Street, or at least critically, the media had been. I really did forget. The reason why I did this is because I also had forgotten how together we were. There is something to be said about Occupy Wall Street. It wasn't about small issues. It was about big issues, which had microscopic effects on our lives. And I truthfully believe, because, you know, I'm a big spiritually active person, you know, I believe the ancestors are calling for something like this again. And that's one of the reasons why I did it, because the energy is there to really foment a major grassroots movement that's similar to Occupy. That's the biggest fear of the wealthy. And that's the other reason why I did it, because I wanted to remind you of that fear. Because we take in that fear and we believe that fear is our fear. Do I want social unrest? I had somebody ask me that. I had a conservative ask me that. Why do you like social unrest? Social unrest and social upheaval or something like that. And I said, I like social activation. We live in a democracy, not a dictatorship. People need to hold accountable their government. You tell me that. But when I say they need to go to the other place, which is preventing them from holding their government accountable, which is corporations, then you have a problem. What are you, a fascist? Or are you a Republican conservative? And it's kind of funny because they don't get that the two of them things are not exclusive or mutually exclusive. They are very much tied together sometimes. You can be a Republican conservative, which a republic is ruled by an oligarchy. It's ruled by an aristocracy. And an aristocracy and an oligarchy have at various times in the very short history of the nation state and beyond have moved towards fascism and have enabled dictatorial rule to prevent what they say is social upheaval and social unrest. But they don't get that. If you do not encourage social activation and social engagement from the grassroots level, you get a stale society. And if you have a body, and I'll use this as a metaphor because I think it's just the best way to do this. If you've ever woken up and you've had a stiff back, a stiff neck, a stiff leg, or what have you, and then you got to move through the process of making it unstiff, you know the type of pain that you go through to get that unstiff. You know that. This is the same thing that's happening with this society. This society has grown stale and stiff because one group wants everyone to just shut up about everything, unless it's corporate friendly. And the other group has been involved in boutique activism, which isn't really helping the grassroots. And this, by the way, is or was an early complaint of radicals, real radicals, because I listened to a couple of podcasts back then of real radicals who had been on the ground doing the work for decades on the same topics that were being covered by Occupy. This was one of their major critiques of Occupy, is that Occupy wasn't connecting with the people at the ground, a lot of those being brown and black. Occupy started doing some of that stuff. Not every layer of Occupy was doing it. Not everybody in Occupy was doing it, but there were some major connections, and you've seen this in offshoots over the coming, over the next 2 years after Occupy was split up. You've seen those offshoots operating. But the fear, and I feel like I need to really just emphasize this part here. The fear of that engagement when it comes to conservatives is that they won't have an opportunity to be born rich. That they won't have the opportunity to become rich. Most of these people, by the way, are middle-aged, will not ever be in a position to become rich. And yet they are still holding out hope. The funny thing also about this is, though, and I keep saying this because it is something that needs to happen. Occupy Wall Street, when you look at the declaration that they released, and I don't even know if you can still get it online, by the way, what you see is a very conservative document. This is what floors me about a lot of the critiques of Occupy Wall Street from back then from conservatives, is you see a very conservative document. One that says these corporations have been given way too much power. They need to be curtailed in order to not step on ordinary people. Now, conservatives used to believe that too much government intrusion was bad, but also too much corporate intrusion was bad. They have been flipped now to be fascistic in the idea that corporations have as much power as they want, they do what they want, but the government needs to be crushed. That's a fascistic concept. This is why I believe Occupy Wall Street may be making a comeback soon. Because a lot of conservatives are starting to wake up to the idea that they have been bamboozled and they have been tricked. Look, follow the trajectory, ladies and gentlemen. It's been 40 years. Follow the trajectory. In fact, it's been 50 years, a little bit over. They first elect, they go from Eisenhower in the early 50s to Richard Nixon in 68. Richard Nixon had a little bit of a conscience, a lot less of one, but he had a little bit of one. He did some very powerful and positive things for the country. And then they go from Nixon, not even going to cover Ford because he was an extension of Nixon, to Ronald Reagan. Now, Ronald Reagan represents the new conservative, this neoconservative concept where corporations are better than government. The New Deal is evil. If you want social welfare, commonwealth to be implemented at a governmental level, then you're evil. And there's something wrong with you. If you want unions to help maintain stability in the society and to grow and to be healthy and to encourage communities and companies to be healthy, then there's something wrong with you. You're anti-American. You're evil. You need to be shut down. That was what the Reagan Revolution brought into existence. Corporate heavy-handedness. And people lapped it up. Because they were told that if they followed the Reagan Revolution, if they let Reagan, you know, cut government down to size, then corporations were going to just explode and the United States would enter a prosperous era like they've never seen before. Forgetting, of course, what actually caused prosperity in the 1950s and 60s. There was also a big racist element in this, but we aren't going to talk about that. Because it's less important. It's important to me, but it's less important than seeing the trajectory of the evolution of conservative candidates. Because Ronald Reagan led to Donald Trump. Ronald Reagan, people often talk about how unstable Donald Trump was. Ronald Reagan, I mean, historians now absolutely see him as going through the stages, the early stages of Alzheimer's. In his presidency, which probably means people like George Bush exerted a lot more authority over decision-making than people give him credit for. And if I read an article a couple of years back where they were actually saying, this was a mainstream source, where they were saying they believe Ronald Reagan started exhibiting Alzheimer's symptoms in his first term. Meaning he was going and sliding deep into it in his second term. What probably saved him is he was an actor. So he had to have a long memory to do acting. Now there's a spiritual theory. There's a book that I actually found which tied dementia to spirituality. But there's a spiritual theory outside of that book and from other spiritual readings that I've had, that I've read, that I really believe this is what causes dementia sometimes, other than the fact that there is evidence of a physical concept where there is something that is on the brain that is causing the brain to malfunction. Gary Nall talked about this, this fungus that gets in there and you have to actually take something to kill it in order to restore the health and the balance of the brain. The theory of dementia and Alzheimer's is that the people who get it are divorced from their true selves. And so their personality is clashing, or should I say has moved far away from their actual soul. And so there's not an exchanging of energy that is happening there. I don't know how true it is, but that's a theory. That said, he was sliding deep into it. So now, then you get George H.W. Bush, who is not as corporatist and gung-ho corporatist in some aspects as Ronald Reagan was. And part of his downfall was the fact that he was not as pro-corporatist. Now, his son comes in and is levels higher than him when it comes to being pro-corporatist. But even he, it is said, had questions about how pro-corporatist he was being forced to become by those individuals creating the national agenda. He even made statements which were questioning, why are we constantly doing all these positive things for corporations? This is not going to help people at the lower level of the society. He made those during his first term, did not, as far as I could tell, make them so much in his second term. He was a puppet who could kind of think. He was farther ahead of Ronald Reagan because he did have the wherewithal to know what he was doing and know that sometimes it was right and sometimes it was wrong. Ronald Reagan, you kind of wonder if he was just reading from a script. And then you get Donald Trump, who is massively pro-corporation. The difference between Donald Trump, Ronald Reagan, and George W. Bush is Donald Trump is unstable, very unstable. He obviously has some form of dementia going. And yet, he is stable enough and mentally clear enough to not care about the effects of what he's doing. Now, it's possible that he doesn't even have dementia. Because I should probably walk that back. Maybe I would say he probably doesn't have dementia. But emotionally, he is unstable. Psychologically, he is unstable. And that instability enables him to do things which would cause a conscience-bearing person to question his actions, to help him not really question his actions. He'd just do it and say, who cares who gets hurt? Ronald Reagan could at least see moralistically sometimes that his actions were going to be negative. And so there were certain things that he wouldn't do. When the Savings and Loan scandal of the late 1980s happened, he put people in jail. Because that's what a government's supposed to do. Donald Trump, if something like that was to happen today, wouldn't even hesitate not to do that. He wouldn't even think about not doing that. In fact, Bush should have locked up tons of Enron people, didn't do it. Obama should have, didn't do it, but Obama's not a Republican. What I'm saying is, ladies and gentlemen, is you can see patterns of personality implemented throughout the last 40 years. And you could also see, if you extend it 50 years, you can see how each president that the conservatives have elected has become less and less and less liberal and more autocratic in a very corporatist side. There are things that Nixon did that Reagan would have never done. It was deemed too liberal for Reagan. It was deemed way too liberal for Reagan. And there were things that Reagan did, and even Bush, I'll count Bush 1 in the whole Reagan equation, that were way too liberal for George W. Way too liberal for George W. And there are things that even George W. did that are way too liberal for Donald Trump. Now, I have been thinking about something recently, and I implore you to think about it also, because I think beyond it being massively important, it should instruct how you conduct yourself over the coming 10 years. I mean this. I said 10 years, and I'm not joking. How are you going to interact with other people who don't believe what you believe And why are you going to interact with them in that way? My question is this, and it really isn't a question, it's a statement, but I'm going to pose it in a question. I'm going to try to anyway. What comes next after Donald Trump? Because people literally were talking about it couldn't get worse after George W. Bush, that the Republicans would not vote for somebody who was worse than George W. Bush. What comes next after Donald Trump? See, because I can tell you, the wealthy already, they have it in their minds what's coming next with the Democrats, because they see that there's a generational push leftward. So you're going to get major reforms with capitalism, you're going to get socialism on the left. They see that coming. What I'm seeing set up at the bottom portion of the Republican Party, particularly at the grassroots level, who they keep electing to these new positions of power for the Republican Party, is frightening. Because these people have incredibly autocratic mindsets, authoritarian mindsets. Some of these people do not mind using violence to get across the point. And there is this insane reverence for militaristic entities, organizations, and violent organizations, whether those organizations are verbally violent, psychologically violent, or physically violent. We see an exodus. This is something that I've been watching on the broadcast. We've seen an exodus of Republicans, particularly in Texas, some other places. That's not always going to stand. Don't get it twisted. But in some of those places where we're seeing the exodus, you're seeing, I mean, these are hardcore conservatives, but they are not Donald Trump type conservatives. A lot of the new conservatives that you're seeing elected are very, very Donald Trumpish. Which again leads me to the question, what comes after Donald Trump? Who are these people going to be voting for? If not in 2020, because there's going to be possibly a couple of challengers to Donald Trump and the Republican side, 2020. But in 2024, who are they really going to be voting for? Again, there's this mass exodus happening. And some of these people who are leaving have been conservative Republicans for decades. Some of them for a decade and a half, some of them just for a decade, some of them for less than a decade. But they are leaving. And most of these conservatives look a lot better than Donald Trump. So who's going to replace them? And who will be on the agenda to be voted for in 2024? And you know what's funny is I didn't even really touch on voting in this piece, and I probably should have, but the reason why I should have talked about voting is because there is a huge push after Occupy Wall Street to really constrict the number of people who can vote, to make it harder to vote, and to push these voting machines, which could be tampered with, into more and more districts. But I guess that's for another day. The reason why I say that questioning who's after Donald Trump is it shouldn't influence how you're going to interact with people who don't believe what you believe in for the next 10 years is because we have about 10 years to remake this country. And so the seeds that you were planting when you were talking to people about this stuff will bloom during that 10 years. And if you are hostile, if you are massively critical and abusive to them because of their beliefs, and you don't try to communicate compassion to them, because look, that's one of the biggest problems that I have with progressives, is a lot of them are too damn self-righteous. When they're talking to conservatives, they want conservatives to feel stupid and to feel like, yeah, okay, I'm overwhelmed by facts, you're smarter than me, I'm just going to give in. No, that is the worst way you can do this, because most of these people have been feeling that their whole lives. So if you're talking to them like that, all you're doing is just creating more pain and suffering for them, and they're going to then inflict it onto you. But if you talk to them in a very compassionate way, and you try to build a structure of open communication and intimacy with them, and it's going to take time. It's not going to happen overnight. They didn't transform themselves overnight. But if you do that with some of them, you're going to see in 2 and 3 and 4 years that they're going to be in a very different place. And it's going to be because of your compassion and your openness and your love for them. A lot of these people are starting to lean towards authoritarianism because it's easy. They need a mother or father figure to go in there just to make everything, you know, good again. Well, that has never worked. It's never worked. I mean, it wasn't a marathon. This is definitely not. I've listened to podcasts which are much longer than this. So, I can't really say, you know, it was long, but wow. Over an hour. I did have another clip which I was going to play, but I'm just going to not play it. I'm just not going to play it. It's already over 2 hours. So, I do have an addendum, which I am going to put together for this, which has to do with Michael Brown, Occupy Wall Street, and, you know, what's funny is I recorded it before I recorded this one. I was going to use the clips, which are at the beginning of this episode, for that one, but I knew that there was something bigger that needed to be talked about, and so I just re-recorded it and did this one. There is so much, man, family. The connection, man, it floors me. But I want to give a quick shout out and rest in peace to Michael Rupert. Because he killed himself. He committed suicide. If you don't know who he is, you can Google him, Michael Rupert. He killed himself in 2014. He killed himself in 2014. And he produced some very... He had his own podcast called The Lifeboat Hour. And he produced some very interesting episodes surrounding Occupy Wall Street. And when Occupy Wall Street was broken up, he started weeping. And he said that was because that was the last great hope for really healing this country and this land. I hope to prove him wrong. I hope we can do one more. Great hope. And I've always wondered, you know, why he was weeping. I think I get it. When I meditate on it, I get it. He studied with Native Americans and became very fond of some of their sacred traditions. And when you study and you meditate with great reverence for that sacred tradition, you start opening up to certain things. Now, I didn't do a lot of Native American stuff, but I have done a lot of African-centered stuff. And that's another sacred tradition which was brought over with, you know, obviously people like myself and my family. And I could see what he sees sometimes. I could see what he's seen. There's a darkness. There is a darkness that has really fallen over the land since Occupy Wall Street was destroyed. There is this darkness that I, you know, spiritual people probably can perceive, but I think other people could also. And there's this diabolicalness that you can just feel bubbling up within the very wealthy in this country. I was thinking the other day, and I do mean, you know, I'm going to end this soon, but I was thinking the other day, if Michael Rupert had lived, because he, when he killed himself, he left a note. And I don't mean to sound so kind of like disconnected when I say he killed himself. But he committed suicide. He left a note. And he said that he was making a flesh sacrifice to, in hopes of saving the country, saving the world, and what have you. And, you know, this is in the traditions, in the more sacred traditions, you know, to make a flesh sacrifice is a big deal. It's a major big deal. And I thought for a long time about that. I went, wow, he figured that things were so bad that this is what you need. You need a flesh sacrifice to resurrect the country. I couldn't see it a lot then. I could see it now. And I wonder sometimes, you know, if it was worth it for him. I do. I wonder if it was worth it for him. I was thinking the other day about him, and that's what made me want to put this on here. And I was thinking, you know, what would he really say if he was still living and he was seeing what was happening with Donald Trump? And truthfully, I don't know what he would say. But I do know this. Some of you who are listening to this are preparing for social actions of various sorts. And most of you aren't caring about history. You just want to make sure that somebody does something in this time period. Focus your energy. Focus your energy and figure out when you should act and why you're acting. Write down in a journal why you're acting. Give yourself 2 or 3 points of why you are acting and write the date down, date and time. And try to do it from a spiritual point. You are acting to spiritually create this. You are acting to spiritually infuse this. You are acting to spiritually engage with this shadow portion of the United States. And if you don't know what a shadow portion is, you can look it up. So those are the 3 aspects that you want to really write on. And the reason why you want to do this is because it adds some multidimensionality to what you're doing, which is often missing in the actions that we are undertaking. But it'll add some multidimensionality and some other stuff, and it'll help you out a lot. Occupy Wall Street didn't have much of a spiritual tone to it. And I wonder sometimes if it had, if it would have survived a lot longer. We need that spiritual aspect again. Because a person like Donald Trump is creating death and destruction because he's essentially an energy vampire. He's a walking black hole. He's just sucking up energy, particularly positive energy, in order to leave a vacuum where evil can thrive. And I do mean thrive this time. We have to become spiritually stronger so we can rebuff him and heal that which is around us, which has been spiritually destroyed. That's the true message. A lot of people, you know, they'd look at the idea of Occupy and say, well, you know, occupation, man, that's what imperialists do, and that's what the Europeans did to the Native Americans. And I look at it as a on another level, because yeah, that those things are true. But Occupy can also be a very positive concept, especially when you're trying to heal the body. There are times when you know, you need to insert medication into the body to help heal it. And even though we would say, well, you know, you're just putting the medication in there, in fact, that medication is occupying the body to do a specific job, and then it'll be flushed out. And that's what Occupy is, and that's what Occupy was on a spiritual level. The body, in and of itself, has a mechanism. It's called inflammation, which sends material and energies to a specific area of the body and occupies it to heal it, to make it whole again. And then as soon as that healing and that wholeness is restored, it relieves the pressure and goes other places. And the body returns to a natural state of stasis. That's the spiritual concept of Occupy. That's the biological concept of Occupy. Now, the immigration protests that we see, many of these are Occupy-style movements, or should I say sit-ins. The protests at the Venezuelan embassy was a Occupy-style engagement, and we won't even look at it that way. Now, there's another reason why I'm talking about this in a spiritual aspect too, because there is a power, there's a force that was created and initiated. It wasn't dissipated, by the way, in 2011 when Occupy Wall Street actually started coming together. There was a force that was placed into the atmosphere. And that force has been waiting to be reattached to. That energy is still there. That positive, powerful energy is still there. And a lot of what you are seeing, the activities that you are seeing, it's growing that energy. That synergy also. In other words, we are ripe for an explosion of activity, activism, and true change. There is so much going on underneath the surface, and people just aren't aware. And a lot of it started with Occupy. A lot of it started with Occupy. That's going to be it. That's going to be it for today. At least I think so. And I'm saying that because I'm looking and I'm thinking, okay, was there anything else that I wanted to get into? No, that'll be it. So if you have any questions, concerns, by the way, I do want to make a suggestion of a book. Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth, with Bill Moyers, by the way. Joseph Campbell, The Power of Myth. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, please, please, please don't hesitate. Use the email. Now, I don't know if the email comes through. I put it on the radioforall.net page. So I don't know if it always comes through for you guys. But if you look on the front of the cover that comes with each episode, my email address is actually there. So I figured I probably should let you know that. So yeah, if you every picture that I put on every episode, my email address, it's in blue at the bottom, is there. So if you ever want to just reach out to me, let me know what you think about the show. Let me know what you think about the concepts that I'm talking about. Or if you have an idea for a show, you know, you can go straight to that and just email me. Boom. That's it. Let me get out before I change my mind. I will see you on the next one. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom, and we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own, or the people who find they can't take anymore, and they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone, and they're alive.